Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. All of our WNST and Baltimore Positive programming brought to you by the original sponsors. That's our friends at Fadley's down in Lexington Market, where I picked up some fresh steak fish last week and fried that up in a pan. It was delicious. And, of course, the mac and cheese I love as well. You can ship that anywhere in the world from our friends at Fadley's. You can get them in Catonsville, hopefully coming sooner than later at the end of the pandemic. They're remodeling over there in Frederick Road, right in the same parking lot with our friends at State Fair in El Guapo. I've been in a mood for an alfresco margarita. I'm waiting for the first 62-degree day. We're going over there for the outdoor. State Fair, we're there with the chicken and waffles as well. My wife and I are going to get over there. And, of course, we're reopening the city and the county. And Don, you booked Ron Cassie on the program. Let's see. It was, I remember this. I said yes in the calendar. It was before the insurrection, before the impeachment, before the inauguration, and certainly before, you know, COVID's reopening restaurants and his incredible story on the life of Dante Barksdale, which he also featured in his book. So we have a lot of ground to cover with your pal, right?
And including the latest, the January edition of Baltimore Magazine.
Don't make me get my Michi's little Italy
meatballs. Incredible story on Little Italy, which was the main reason we were going to get Ron back on. But since then, all hell's broken loose. And then the sun's come out, and it's been an amazing time in America. So we are well pleased to welcome back senior editor at Baltimore Magazine, Ron Cassie. Ron, how are you?
Oh, good. Thanks so much for having me, guys. I really appreciate it.
We appreciate you coming back.
Dude, I don't even know where to begin, man. Like, I first things first, you were in the middle of the insurrection. Like, you, what was a nice guy like you choosing to be in a place like that?
Yeah, I'll try to, you know, Joe Giordano, Baltimore photographer, has covered a lot of the Trump rallies. And, you know, as you know, being a journalist, we just had... My response was kind of the print issue on Wednesday. We're going on Friday. We're kind of done. And I just thought, well, let me just run down there with him and just document it. Talk to some Maryland folks, talk to some Baltimore folks. And, you know, I'd cover the Trump's appearance, campaign appearance at the convention center. So we were at the Ellipse, the rally. We walked over to Black Lives Matter Plaza afterwards. Not a lot happening there, except a lot of people walk into the Capitol, you know, from the Ellipse to past Black Lives
Matter. So you didn't hear the Trump speeches? You were away during that period of time?
We didn't actually hear them. We were in the crowd, but we're not really close enough to really get, there's a lot of people there.
It's an enormous area, right? I mean,
enormous area. Plus, they're, you know, the COVID thing, you know, Nestor, they're not wearing masks. And I had two on the whole time. And it was a little, honestly, you're like, I don't know if I want to be in the middle of 10,000 people without masks for a couple hours waiting for this to happen. So I was on the outskirts of the rally, Washington Monument, talking to people. And then after he wrapped up, we went to Black Lives Matter Plaza and people were walking past on the way to the Capitol. And we were just like grabbing a cup of coffee and Joe got some pictures. And we were just shouting back and forth a little bit, not a few protesters, anti-protesters there. And Joe got a text from his wife saying, hey, something's going on at the Capitol. There's like people like scaling the wall. And it was like 2 o'clock and Joe and I were basically like ready to head back to Baltimore. And so we drove down to the Capitol. You know, in DC, amazingly, we got there very quickly. I parked a block from Constitution Avenue.
I mean, Ron, I want you to keep going. But think about that, Nestor, think about that. And I want you to talk about that. In the midst of this craziness and what was supposed to be preparation, you and Joe are just driving around like it's another regular winter day. That's bizarre.
Yeah, like you're going to see Simple Minds at DAR Constitution Hall or
it's
something,
weird.
Right?
Except there's no traffic anywhere. There's no traffic. There's not even police, National Guard. There's nobody on the streets, right? Like, I rode my bike up to get my truck, drove, right? We picked up my truck, which was on Connecticut Avenue. We drove down there, got there like that, parked a block away. And immediately walked, we could see people scaling the side, immediately walked up, hustled up. And, you know, of course, all you actually had to do was walk around to the steps and walk to the Capitol. There was no reason to scale. And we were at the front door, I think it's like the north entrance. Actually, it's an exit we were at. And Joe and I were literally at the doorstep. Guys had flagpoles. They were beating the door, breaking windows, bum rushing the doors.
FBI has your phone number now? I mean, you were close enough for that?
Oh, yeah. Joe submitted videos to the FBI. Yeah. We were both tear gassed, pepperballed. Joe got much worse than I did. I have eyeglasses and was able to turn faster. I video.
Were you prepared for a riot? I mean, were you dressed as though maybe, because clearly there were a lot of people up front that were ready for it. Kind of like when I've been in a baseball locker room, you wear goggles because you just know eyes are the first thing, right?
No, I mean, I wear eyeglasses, but, you know, we both had COVID masks. That was it. No, we weren't prepared. I mean, Joe's a former MP in the Army. And so I followed him. But we went right to the very front. I mean, literally, like, we were reaching our arms in with our cameras, seeing down the hallways, and they would bum rush and they get pepper sprayed. And it was an exit. So with multiple doors, they weren't able to penetrate there. But the real action, of course, we learned while we were there, somebody had been shot inside. I mean, we were at the Capitol door on the side when that happened. And we eventually went around to the front, and people were at that point being leaving the Capitol who had gone in. Now, by that time, we had seen Montgomery County Police and District Police arrive. And I met, you know, the guy who sat in, it's in our story, the guy who sat in Nancy Pelosi's chair, pulled the letter out. I interviewed him. Joe is the best photograph of him. Joe is some of the best photographs of that melee of anybody, if you want to look at our story. The confrontations between police, like you're at the line of scrimmage and the Trump rally. It was completely surreal. We were not prepared nor expecting anything like that. I think as a journalist, it's the sense of talking to people before at the Ellipse, all day long at the mall. You just learn a lot of firsthand experience, get a sense of where all this rage and misinformation, is coming from.
Well, Ron, go with that for a minute, because you're the first person that I've talked to that's been that close. And I see Nestor nodding. You're the first person that I've talked to that interviewed these people. So take our listeners behind the scenes here. What did you learn in a dispassionate way by talking to people who were motivated to show up to a rally that was going to overturn American democracy?
Okay, yeah. So, you know, just to preface a little bit, you know, Joe Giordano, Nestor probably knows, he's from Dundalk, and his father was a Baltimore cop. And as you guys know, I grew up in Allentown. I would say it's our perspective is, at least for Joe and I, are very comfortable. We fit in, you know, we know a lot of people like this, our family, our high school friends. So that helps, I think, a little bit when you're relating to people and trying to honestly, dispassionately hear what's going on. From the Ellipse, like, it was really clear. I probably spoke to 25 or 30 people leading up to that Trump speech at 11:30 in the morning there. It's a wide variety of people, first of all. There's real estate owners, there's small business people, there's blue collar people, there's Orthodox Jews in the mix and Chinese Americans for Trump. It's a really wide swath. There's a lot of like anti-abortionists and evangelical Christians. There's QAnon folks. There's crazy white supremacist group people, Proud Boys. You see them with those plates on their chest and the Oath Takers. It's almost like a nesting ground of every conspiracy theorist group you can mine. And everybody you talk to has their own kind of theory. I mean, they're all completely bought into the idea that the election was stolen. That's number one. And that they're doing their patriotic duty to disrupt the certification. They believe.
Well, they all watch Fox News, right? That's another real sort of baseline. I would think 80 to 90% that's, and from there to the further right of there. From there toward Alex Jones and whatever OANN and whatever the hell that is, right?
Yes, exactly. And that can't be dismissed because, you know, we all watch Fox News. If you go to the gym or the bar or whatever, it's on. You know, we all catch some of it. And they're spending a lot of time. I think you can read some reporting about this, that Alex Jones, Glenn Beck, the YouTube channels, QAnon, like Newsmax, OAN, their viewerships are surpassing Fox News, right? Fox News is receding. And
Fox News isn't giving them enough raw meat.
Yeah, it's receding. Yeah, the level of it's you know, it's not it's losing viewers and strangely enough through all this. And so there are folks that part they believe wholeheartedly. Now, when you talk to people, and they'll say, you know, what? But they'll go on about Georgia, and I'll say, well, you know, you can go to the Georgia state government election website, and it's all there, county by county. I mean, just like in Pennsylvania, you know, or Maryland, where I am, you can go, and it's all there. And they'll just be some quiet or look at you funny, like. Clearly, they're not getting information from the same places, like credible sources, or doing really like firsthand research. Like if you go to the Georgia state government board of elections, you can see tallies. You can see Pennsylvania and county by county, so yeah.
Well, the Georgia elections were all Republicans. They all admitted to voting for Trump, and then they stood there every day and predicted exactly what was going to happen.
Yeah,
right?
So they're buying the narrative that they're hearing from people they believe have their best interests at heart that they associate with. You know, just like we all do, we all have a predilection to believe stuff we want to hear. We believe stuff that our friends and family tell us over anybody else, right, that are closest, our circles, you know, the silos that we're in. And clearly that has sunken in completely. And I think, you know, if anything, the media has done a real disservice not paying attention to that, not just over the last 4 years, but even longer. And the kind of both sides journalism that I abhor, I think it never enlightens anyone to say both sides dot, dot, dot. Like, it's always more enlightening to parse out what one side said and the other, like just to explain it in those ways. Both sides scored 10 points is the same as saying a tie in a football game. That's fine. But most likely, they did not even score those 10 points in the same way. So don't, it's too easy of a fallback and you know, go a little deeper.
It's lazy.
Ryan, you've touched.
It's intellectually lazy.
Have you touched my nerve?
Intellectually lazy. That's what I mean.
It's intellectually lazy.
Well, I mean, you get 50,000 people down there climbing the Capitol. At the heart of all of it is a flood of misinformation and the inability to discern what is a fact. And Ron, I'm guilty of this at 52. I've been doing this my whole life. And I think we went through this where I have stood with a notebook in front of people my whole life. Mueller and I went through this with Jen Psaki the other night when she came out. I've stood in front of those people my whole life wondering, are you full of shit or are you telling me the truth? And then I have to figure out whether they're telling me the truth, because this is what I've done for a living. It's what you've done for a living. A lot of people aren't equipped for this. Really.
And I told Nestor, Ron, that in watching, we're jumping all around, but in watching Jen Psaki, to me, it was a breath of fresh air, because it was someone who came out, who had a respect for the press, who said, we're going to do this every day. Much in a CJ, I felt like I was back in an episode of West Wing, right? And CJ Craig was coming out to meet with the press every day with the goal of telling the truth. And I contrast that with, go back to Sean Spicer's first briefing 4 years ago, when he wanted to blatantly lie about crowd size when he didn't have to. I mean, that was one of the many clues, right? That nobody cared about crowd size except one person, and Sean Spicer therefore was forced to lie about crowd size. Therefore,
Ron, that would bring me back to the insurrection with you, where my fear for you is standing down amongst these people and saying, I'm a journalist. I saw what was happening to journalists there and everywhere. Yeah. And to your point, you know, Joe can take care of himself and all that, but it was very clear to me there were a lot of weapons there. I mean, I saw that in the morning. I saw the kind of people that were there that would brandish weapons, the Michigans, that my thought all along was weaponry and not tear gas as much as somebody taking a bomb in there. That was my thought all along.
Well, you know, just I can go back a little bit further. I was a bike messenger in D.C. for 5 years, and I was there before 9/11 and after. And I can tell you, I was at the Capitol multiple times a week. And there's a metal detector. You're wanded. You have to call somebody to come down, sign in, show state ID. And so the police presence, when we first arrived there, and I'm looking down the hallway and seeing how these guys are dressed, just reminded me of a normal day at the Capitol. Clearly, people have been told to stand down, stand away, stay away before that. That's part of it. And to your point, that was the first thought was, you know, most of these people are, you know, really are not armed. They probably could have gone to their vehicles and pulled weapons out. And thank God the Capitol Police showed incredible restraint, because it could have been, a really terrible bloodbath. And anybody could have, brought in a bomb and set it off or start a fire. It's really a miracle that there was not one Timothy McVeigh type or something among that group that did that. It's really just a miracle. You can only just say it's thankful, but it's like just dumb luck, because, people were just streaming in completely. It was incredible.
Was there a point, Ron, where you and Joe were afraid, where you thought, we're in over our heads here and something bad might happen to us?
I think I probably missed that fear of consequences gene a little bit or something. It's a little bit of, you're just in the moment, and where are my surroundings and stuff like that. We didn't have anything that said CNN on us or anything that would immediately pick us out. And I think people look at two middle-aged white guys like me and Joe and figure, we're with them. They're all taking videos and stuff. Right.
Right. You're one of them.
A few moments. Sure. When the police are coming out and they've got pepper ball guns pointed, I don't know exactly what's a real gun from a pepper gun and all that kind of stuff. And when they're met, there's a few times with the crowd being pushed, we almost got knocked over. Right. And people get trampled. There's a little bit of that, but, mostly it's a little bit, the videos that came out of what happened inside, we weren't quite aware of at that time, because we're on the outside of the building. And on the outside, it felt like after an NBA team or NFL team wins like a championship, right? It's kind of a melee. It's kind of a party. It's cars being, it's kind of that kind of vibe. That was really surreal.
So Ron, you chatted with these folks, and it's not fair to ask you to take, an hour or 2 hours of conversation and sort of summarize the past president's appeal. A big question I have for you, though, in those conversations, do we make a mistake when we jump to race as the major motivator? Are there many, many more factors at work, or when you slice and dice it and it comes out in the wash, is at its core, is it about race?
The blame, the pointing the fingers at somebody else is certainly that's certainly directly tied to race, right? Whether it's Muslim, Mexican, Central American, and Black American.
Not one of us.
Not one of us. That outsider, they're not but the, partly I think is, a failure just of leadership. You can appeal to our country and our individuals, the better nature, angels of our nature, when times are tough, and times are tough for a lot of people, and leadership and politicians for 50 years have not paid enough attention to the problems of working and middle-class folks in this country whose real wages have just shrunk amid unbelievable increases in wealth and gross national product. So it's real, very real that people have not paid attention to that across working class, blue collar, middle class families. But what Trump does, and there's others before him as well, is they take that, that resentment, that anxiety, and they point it at the other. They're to blame, not you. It's these people. And that is very real. I mean, that there's people shouting, F George Floyd. This is what Joe and I are hearing when we're at the door. F Black Lives Matter, F George Floyd, take our country back. I mean, it's built into that kind of mentality.
Ron Cassie is our guest, of course, at Baltimore Magazine. We have been talking about the insurrection, the aftermath, the inauguration. I want to switch gears a little bit. Obviously, we encourage everyone to go read and maybe bring this into the Baltimore side of things, because we did invite you on to talk about Little Italy and going out. And we've had Brandon Scott on literally earlier today. You can find that out at Baltimore Positive, as well as our conversation with Senate President Bill Ferguson about Kerwin and vaccines and all of the things we've been talking about. But the common thread today has been, and Don and I did not have the privilege to know Dante Barksdale. We were chasing him around for a year or two, trying to get him onto the program. And James Bond had a long, friendship and working relationship with Safe Streets all this time. we're Baltimore positive. We talked all this national stuff and whatever. Boy, this is, you know, been a tough week around here on that front. And for anyone like you that chronicled his work, I want to give you as much oxygen as you can, because a real civic tragedy here this week amidst a lot of other things going on.
Yeah, thank you, Nestor. You know, Dante Barksdale is, you know, was a transformational leader in this city. You know, maybe only Erica Bridgeford today holds a similar place in terms of being a peacemaker in the city, being a spiritual leader in the city, and also having, you know, really both of their boots on the ground, you know, in this city, and in struggling communities and working to prevent gun violence.
What do they do? What does that mean? Working to prevent
Dante
gun violence.
Barksdale's, you know, Dante Barksdale's case, I met Dante 12 years ago, profile, one of the first profiles of Safe Streets for Baltimore Magazine. I was just a freelancer then. And, you know, he welcomed me in, you know, and I followed him on a vigil after shooting McElderry Park, which, as you know, I live on the north side of Patterson Park. McElderry Park is very close. That Safe Streets office was right on Monument Street. Dante used to live on North Patterson Park Avenue. Invited me in, I mean, to go along to spend, you know, a day or two with him. I met all the guys at Safe Streets, Leon Farouk. And what Dante did was put his body in harm's way himself, right? Like, he, on the streets at night, whenever his phone rang, he responded, hey, there's a beef, there's a dispute, there's something going on. And Dante, because of his own credibility growing up, in East Baltimore, Lafayette Homes, knowing everybody that he does, being respected as somebody who turned his life around after kind of being in that, you know, criminal life, had enormous respect. And so he was on call 24/7 to mediate disputes and saved countless lives, undoubtedly, in the city. But it's also like the way he was as a human being. He was warm and funny and a larger-than-life personality, sarcastic. And, you know,
street smart beyond belief, right?
Street smart beyond belief and smart beyond belief and serious, you know, as funny and sarcastic as he was, this was a man with a serious purpose in life and never lost sight of that. Whether he was in City Hall, you know, when he was lecturing, Daniel Webster with Hopkins, would invite Dante to speak to public health graduate students. And he could be in any of those spaces and be authentic and himself and bring wisdom and understanding and compassion and human heart. He earned a bachelor's degree, a master's degree. You know, just a genuine, somebody you genuinely admire. And, you know, it's...
so many people knew him that I knew. And, you know, for me, it's a loss from TV and a person that knew people. For all of you who knew him, I you know... I feel cheated out of not knowing him, to be really honest.
Yeah,
with you.
So I, you know, I was friends with Dante on Facebook all these years, but didn't rarely, you know, ran to him once in a while. Like, we all have a lot of friends or acquaintances in Baltimore you wish you saw more of and stuff like that. But, you know, followed. I read his book that he did, his memoir. And then I was on the show talking about it with you guys, our story on the Iron Pipeline, gun trafficking. You know, Dante was a really key source, probably the key like street source for that story about where these guns come from and how kids get their hands on them. And, you know, in hindsight, you know, I'm thankful. It's tragic, but I'm thankful that we, you know, Joe Giordano, I just mentioned, took a portrait of Dante for that story and Erica Bridgeford as well. They're really close. And to have those two together, I was really grateful that I got a chance to spend a couple of days with Dante and have a half dozen conversations with him again. And it was heartbreaking, you know, to get that. Brandon Soderberger, who used to work at the city paper, sent me a text. He was hearing about Dante being killed on Sunday morning. And it was heartbreaking, you know, to go to the site where he was killed, to talk to his friends. And
he's a whole chapter, right? In the Baltimore book.
Okay. Yeah. He's the second story in the book, right? That I did. The second story is Dante. It's following him around on a vigil. And really moving perspective about him being in the middle of the street and with a bullhorn, and, you know, we're not going to have this, and we're not going to have guys shoot each other over, you know, some girl who's not even here today. And I think his humor, his intelligence, his compassion, like empathy, his unbelievable energy comes through that story a little bit, hopefully.
Well, I would say to people out there, not only if you're not reading Baltimore Magazine every month to get what Ron's writing. And we're going to talk shortly about the Little Italy story. But his books, if you love Baltimore, other books are all out there. They're at the local bookstores. They're at the Big Giants. Pick up something. Google Ron Cassie and get his work, because it's really terrific, terrific work. Ron, why was there always this subplot where Baltimore City police weren't buying what Safe Streets were selling? They always thought it was a scam, so to speak. Maybe a bit harsh, but probably not too harsh. Why was that? Where was that disconnect?
Well, that's a complicated story, I think, to unpack. And I'll first say that, you know, like with everything, and I know you guys know this, it's not all police officers who feel that way. There's certainly some folks who do in the department, some folks at the top who see them essentially like, you know, interceding on their turf, right? Like, they're not reporting people who have, you know, might have a firearm, you know, and they're under 21 on them. They're trying to prevent that guy from pulling the trigger. And that's where their credibility comes, is they're not the police. That's where Dante gets his credibility. He's not the police. And he's trying to, you know, diffuse the situation, the urgency of the moment. And because, you know, a lot of times if you can diffuse that, those, that anger, that aggression, male hormones, if you can diffuse those that teenage reaction in the moment, it won't happen again. You know, a pause button is often really effective way of stopping a shooting. And then Dante's also at Safe Streets are also trying to mentor kids, bring them in, you know, in their fold and get them out of that life. And they set example for them. So it's different than police work. I think there's a, you know, there's a natural place where they're going to butt up against each other, maybe have some resentment. You know, I don't think that's unusual I don't think that's unusual or unexpected.
Well, we are with Ron Cassie, senior editor, Baltimore Magazine. Ron, in my experience in life, very often organizations, companies, you name it, nonprofits, get their juice and their energy from a dynamic leader. And sometimes, unfortunately, when that dynamic leader is no more, the organization ceases to function in the same way. Can Safe Streets survive the loss of a Dante Barksdale?
Well, I think so. Yeah. I mean, you know, I know a few of the other folks there, Gardner Carter, LeVar Mull, and some other folks, you know, early on it lost Leon Farouk, who was the founding director of the Safe Streets McElderry Park. And you know, that was a really big blow. I mean, Leon was older and commanded a tremendous amount of respect. And actually the first workers, he were all guys he self-selected, had been in prison with him. So, you know, it's, I mean, I hope it can continue. It's certainly an enormous blow. Dante being the face of City Streets, to be a role model, it's a huge blow. I think it can also serve as, he'll be held up as an inspiration, you know, I think as well.
Well, the mayor, Nestor mentioned we spoke with the mayor. The mayor was truly moved, emotional, right, Nestor? I mean, I would describe the mayor. You could hear it in his voice. You could see it in his face. This one was a gut punch. So let's hope the city bounces back from this. Ron, but before we jump to Little Italy, which I just found to be a fascinating article, a couple of weeks after the insurrection, you returned to Washington, D.C., to a brand new day, or Let the Sunshine In, or pick whatever song you like. Take our listeners inside the inauguration that recently took place and what it felt like, and give us an up close and personal view.
And were you close enough to see the fireworks? Because they look ridiculous. If I would have known how good the fireworks were going to be, I would have gone down there and found some way to be 10 blocks away to watch them, man.
I came back to write the story, I think, before the fireworks.
They look good on TV, though. That was good with the ice cold beer at home. That works, right?
Yeah. We have great fireworks in Baltimore, right? I can't help it. I always plug Baltimore. We have great fireworks in the harbor.
No, they were just spectacular fireworks. I think they were. We had, well, the fireworks we had here for 10 years ago, we had the 200 year thing we did. What was it called? Celebration. There you go. That was good.
Oh, yeah.
So that was good. That was our inauguration. How about that?
So I, you know, like I said, I mentioned, you know, Joe had been in the service, but I ran into some folks right down there at North Capitol and Louisiana, as close as we could get to the Capitol. You couldn't see anything. The whole thing from the, from like, you know, not RFK, but the whole area from the Supreme Court and the Capitol to the Lincoln Memorial was all surrounded by like 10-foot high fencing, you know, with barricades and wire and armed National Guard troops and camouflage with, you know, long guns. I mean, it was incredible. And they were on street corners outside of the of that protected area as well. You know, I talked to a couple other guys who were in the military, and I thought that was just an interesting perspective, or in the National Guard down there. You know, a guy from Bowie, Maryland, and African-American guy from Bowie, Maryland, and, you know, another photographer actually from Middle River who'd been down earlier in the week to photograph the kind of military buildup and even the National Guard. And they spoke of it just being surreal to being on the outside of the wire, so to speak, in their own country. You know, they had been, Cornelius from Bowie had been in Iraq and been in the Green Zone in Baghdad. And he just was like, it's weird that I'm on the outside, like I'm in enemy territory, so to speak, right? The protected area is the inside. Now I'm on in my own country. That level of military buildup was required or necessary or to be for those people. Was that was one thing that was enlightening. Another thing, of course, you know, as much as I think people have affection for Joe Biden, even, you know, both sides of the aisle, as a nice guy and empathetic man, appreciate the losses in his life. The people there to who were really celebrating the inauguration were really there, I think, celebrating Kamala Harris and, you know, a woman, first, you know, black woman to rise to the second highest office in the country. And there was really, I think, really a lot of genuine enthusiasm. I think people were relieved that Joe Biden was taking the reins and then celebrating Kamala Harris, if that makes sense.
I was losing a pound an hour right around lunchtime, Ron. I mean, all day long, man. I think we all woke up a little lighter on Thursday. Let's get to Baltimore. And, you know, we talked to our mayor, Brandon Scott, about reopening these restaurants. And there you go. You get the magazine up. It's a lovely picture of Sabs. It reminds me of a bookmaker and some rigatoni and meat sauce I need to have sometimes.
Well, Nestor, before you jump into the specifics of this, I want to remind everybody, when we had Max Weiss on, Max pointed out, every month there's some article in here that makes people, when they're in the grocery store, want to go and pick it up and check it out. Folks, by the time you do that, it's much, much cheaper just to jump on Baltimore Magazine and get a subscription.
And you
won't
be
disappointed. It'll come right to your house. It's cheaper, and you'll get Ron Cassie and Max Weiss and all the good stuff every month. So, Nestor, I know this little Italy one is near and dear to your heart.
Well, yeah. It's where I go and walk. So to see Scott over at Amici's talk about the neighborhood and needing people locally to be there, I park my car in Little Italy. I walked a Little Italy. I've been going to Little Italy once a week for the last 30 years. I've played bocce. You know, all of that. So for you to focus on that, I mean, run me through the background of that, and let's talk about saving all these restaurants and saving all of our neighborhoods, because that's what this year needs to be about for all of us, Ron.
Yeah. There's a lot of eggplant and pasta eaten in the production of this story. I'm going to give away whatever some of my bias or interest, right? I mean, my great grandparents are Italian immigrants, you know. I knew my great grandparents, you know, they lived long lives and owned a restaurant, the Jersey Shore, you know, and my family name is Cassieri. And
what kind of restaurant was it? What did they serve? What was your favorite meal there?
It was a little Italian restaurant, the Jersey Shore, eggplant parm.
Man, it sounds like a Billy Joel song.
Meatballs, you know, like, yeah, a little like, you know, Point
bottle
Pleasant.
Bottle of red,
right?
A bottle of white. All right, I got
yeah,
you.
A little
you.
Joint, you know, and my great grandfather, Antonio Tommaso Cassieri worked the front of the house, and Angelina Rondazzo Cassieri, my Sicilian great grandmother, worked the back of the house as her recipes, you know.
Do you have a rolling pin, your grandmother?
My earliest memories as a child are in her kitchen. Really. I mean, you know, she was probably the height and size shape of Barbara Mikulski, if that puts an image, except she wasn't Polish. She was, you know, Italian. Right. And So, and I, you know, go to St. Leo's a lot for church, you know. So I know the neighborhood. I got some friends there I see once in a while, not as often as I'd like, and go to the restaurants. So the interest comes, you know, a little bit from that. But then, you know, it's also this incredibly historic neighborhood in the city.
The world headquarters of Baltimore Magazine's basically there, right? Literally.
Yeah. Yeah. And the world headquarters of the Speaker of the House of Representatives is there. You know, there's a lot of stuff
Nancy
there.
Dallas Andrew Way, you know,
yeah.
you touched on so much of it, Ron, in the story. I want to jump to the end of the story and you make it the beginning, because it's almost near the end of the story where you say, you know, most of these Italians that came here didn't plan to come here. They were heading from New York to the Midwest. Tell that story.
Well, I Baltimore's immigrants at Locust Point or immigration pier came from Eastern Europe, right? Like from Bremen, Germany. So it was Czechs and Slovaks and Poles and Russian Jews and Germans who came. The Italians first and then later the Greeks came from train mostly from New York, from Ellis Island. And many of them were coming for railroad jobs and planning to head west as the B&O and everybody is laying that out. And there are a lot of Italians, obviously, in St. Louis and Milwaukee and all those places, Cleveland, who did.
Amazing heart to think that you're going somewhere and you don't know where you're going, right? Like for most of us, we're like, I took a new job in Detroit. I'm going there. I'm going somewhere beyond Detroit. I don't, you know, like literally it's a mindset that we can't even get our minds around, right?
Yeah, and you're going to and you don't speak the language and you may never see your family again. I mean, as a whole, I mean, the courageousness is incredible. But so President Street Station was built right around the Civil War and the Pratt Street Riot, you know, kind of a famous place. That's where, right next to Little Italy, that's where Italians got off the train before going to plan to go to the Midwest. And there's a couple of Italian-owned boarding houses there, and I think they got a whiff of the pasta and the tomato sauce and garlic and everything, and thought, well, this doesn't look so bad. I'll stay here. And that seems to be what has happened, you know, quite a bit. Those boarding houses right at the President Street Station filled up, and Italians who were planning to, you know, young men mostly, right, planning to go west to work the railroads, and many did, really hard backbreaking labor, but many just, I think, they heard the you know, the siren song of the native tongue and, you know, stayed put, you know, thankfully for us, I guess.
Well, you tell this story through the eyes of so many. One of the folks you tell the story through is a gentleman named Tom Scilipotti and his son, Tom Mozzie, who ends up being a photographer in addition to a barber. So we got the barbershop with the red pole in the row house. We've got the son who becomes the photographer who films Tommy D'Alessandro's inauguration and Nancy Pelosi's wedding. I mean, Mario's Scilipotti and his son, Tom. So you tell that story, and then Mario, I guess, is the one that goes back and brings his family. You talk about come without his family. He goes back, and he comes back a couple years later. So through his eyes and through Tom's eyes, tell that story. But also, Ron, you mentioned St. Leo's. One of the themes that I walked away with when I read this story, and I've had some friends that grew up in Little Italy as well. A friend of mine, Nick Spinato, his family grew up down there. Nick was a legendary Baltimore County educator. And he
Our
still knows
that. By the way, Steve Jeppy, I should note that.
Steve Jeppy. No, you know, they know everybody by name. So I was struck by the pageantry, and correct me if I'm wrong, and the rituals of Little Italy. And that's part of that is St. Leo's, part of it's the fairs, part of it's the bocce courts. Talk about the gestalt of Little Italy, because you captured it.
Well, this is, you bring up some great points, and you know, I think for certain, like kind of like close readers, they'll pick up on some of the points that are like, you know, there is one is, yeah, Mario Scilipotti comes from Sicily as a young man. All he has is like an uncle he's heard about in Baltimore. He comes from New York, makes his way down. And he's here for like 7 years working. He has a wife and a daughter that he doesn't even know he has yet. She's born 8 months after he leaves. Doesn't even know his wife's pregnant when he gets on the ship here. Gets a barber's license, starts a business, goes back. Eventually the family comes and Tom is born, who becomes a photographer as well. Tom is the 90-year-old photographer who has all the great art in this issue. Nestor will know, the Baltimore Guide. He shot for the Baltimore Guide for 66 years. It has to be the longest tenure of any photographer at one newspaper in the country. So there's that great personal story. I think that relates to, like, when we see immigrants today in Southeast Baltimore, you know, people coming here and sending money back home, wanting to bring their family here. If you were Italian when Mario Silipati came, there was no legal or illegal immigration. All you had to do was get on a boat and you were welcomed at Ellis Island, and you know, you were okay.
Give us your poor, you're tired. Gotcha.
Right, you're in. If you don't have a disease, you know, a chronic, you know, a contagious disease, you're in. And, so that resonates. And there's talk, you know, of replacing the Columbus statue with a statue of like an immigrant Italian family, you know, a father and son and daughter. I think that would be fantastic.
Well, that would be beautiful, wouldn't it?
That would be beautiful. It really would resonate in what is such a historically immigrant neighborhood in Southeast Baltimore, the whole larger community, right? I think it would really resonate. And the broader thing too, I think, Don, when you bring it up a little bit, is when we talk about, you know, deindustrialization, not just hits Baltimore, but hits Milwaukee and St. Louis and Flint, Michigan, and Detroit and Toledo and all these places that are struggling today, all these cities around the country, it rips apart some of the fabric of these great communities, which is what you're describing. There's been books written about that, right? There's people don't bowl in the same, they don't go to the same church as the Elks Club, right? People end up leaving the community they were born in, you know, to go somewhere else because the same kind of jobs and stuff aren't there anymore. And so I think Little Italy has survived because all the things Nestor said that keep it glued together, and you did, the church, the bocce courts, the restaurants, all that stuff, the film festival used to do this. I hope it comes back. The Muldinary Arts Festival that Sid Wolf at Germano's has put together. The cabaret nights at Germano's. The history at Sabatino's, you know, I think the outdoor seating that everybody did this year, you know, fosters that kind of community spirit. You naturally, I don't see anybody eating in Amici's when I walk by, but if they're eating outside, I do.
Well, you might see them on Friday. So beginning, you know,
hopefully,
just a little on those businesses. Cause I know that was, you know, at the heart and the target is Little Italy is about a place we go to eat. You know, a lot of us, right? Literally.
Yeah, I mean, that's you know, that was, you know, ultimately, you know, why this story, why now, right? Is these restaurants there are really being hurt. They're family-owned places.
My friends.
Your friends and
your friends.
Yeah, and the generosity, you know, and telling a story and stuff. But it's also emblematic of what's happening around the city, of course, how bad the hospitality industry, how bad the restaurant industry is struggling. So sometimes it's hard to tell whole city struggling and you pick a neighborhood or something. But thank God, in a way, a lot of these family owned places like own the building that they're in and are under a little less financial pressure than some of the other places. They have Sabatino's, Ciparelli's, D'Alessio's, all these places have decades, Vaccaro's have decades of a customer base built up that hopefully they're, you know, staying connected, able to stay connected to. They're doing extraordinary outreach work. I mean, these restaurant owners are doing everything they possibly can to keep those doors open.
Well, here's what I want to do, man. I'm going to share with all of our audience out here. I've created my own little sandwich over at Amici's. I want to share this with you. You know, you've heard of a Sloppy Joe, right, Ron? This is the Sloppy Ness. And what this is you take the cheese bread that they do. They do garlic and cheese, and then they toast it, heavily toasted. And then you get the meatballs, and you get a little bit of the marinara, and you just cut it up, and you make it. I call it a Sloppy Ness. So it's going to catch on. Trust me, it's going to catch on because it's the tastiest thing I've ever had in my life, and you guys should go get one right now. And I'm telling you,
is it on the menu?
No, you got to get it separate. You get the meatballs and the ricotta, okay? And it's an appetizer. I think it's $10.
So I have to make my own sloppy net.
And then it's $5 for the cheese bread, garlic cheese toast, garlic cheese toast, and then you put things together. You got to be creative, Moeller. Not all things come together. You got to move things here.
All right. Well, speaking of that, and speaking of food and people who used to eat there, Ron, it was a trip back again as a nerdy little kid from growing up back in the 50s in Catonsville. And occasionally, you know, mom would take you down to Little Italy and that would be a treat. You talked about the celebrities that passed through there. I mean, it was a who's who, man. We're talking Whitey Ford, Mickey Mantle. Talk a little bit about all that.
Yeah, again, you know, thanks to Tom, we have some photographs of of Whitey Ford and Mickey Mantle and Moose Scout and those guys out for dinner at Roma's and Perry Como at Maria's and all these. It was really the destination for decades, right? Like all the actors and celebrities from the 70s, 80s, Danny DeVito, anybody, I'm going to leave out, all the politicians, Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter came through and,
you had Rocky Marciano.
I don't know where you could go on.
All I'm thinking about right now, given the insurrection, is Do the Right Thing and Sal, put some Italian Americans and put Sinatra on the wall,
Yeah, exactly.
Let's do it. Well, I ate
at every place there. I ate during the, I ate at Isabella's and Angelina's Pizza and Vicaro's and D'Alessio's and Sabatino's.
Give me a couple of your favorite dishes. Seriously, give me a couple of things I need to try.
At La Scala, I had the Fra Diavolo, the shrimp with the spicy sauce, which was fantastic. I mean, that was fantastic. I went to Sav's just for old-fashioned meatballs and spaghetti to remind me of my great-grandmother.
Wait a minute. I'm going to interrupt. I'm doing the worst thing, but it was one of my favorite stories. Because it is one of my favorite sounds. Talk about the origin of the bookmakers. Nestor.
I met him once. I had a salad with him once. Alesker set it up. When Alesker was on the show, Alesker told me 30 years ago we were going to go down and have lunch with Peter Angelos. Angelos didn't show up, but the original bookmaker did.
Right. Walk us through, because Ron, loving that salad, I loved that story.
So part of the story, and I know people appreciate this fact, is going back to what it was really like to grow up in Little Italy, where one of the former Baltimore police officers who's from the area said, Little Italy didn't have, organized crime like New York and Philadelphia. It had disorganized crime. And he was talking about, there's basically like a bookie on every corner, and even I'm old enough that when I was first a bartender in Baltimore, a couple of dive joints, we had poker machines that paid out and I worked for a small time bookie, but the maitre d', they were losing their, this is in the 70s, they're losing their older established bookmaker business. Guys would used to come after Sunday's football games were over, after Monday night football, bookies get together after Monday night game to settle up, but it used to be after Sunday. So guys would come in on Monday for lunch and they were losing some of the crowd. Guys were getting older, couldn't eat as much, and the maitre d' says, I'll come up with something. And he throws together what we know is the bookmaker salad today. He says, I'll name it the bookmaker salad. And these guys will love it. They'll eat it up and they'll come back for it. And that's how it's got its name. The maitre d' was a bookmaker too, by the way, who by his own account was arrested like 50 times. So
Al Acella, right? Was that his name?
Al Acella invented it as a way to keep.
Al is the guy I had lunch with back in the 90s.
Al Acella. I mean, that's why, folks, again, if you're not reading the Little Italy story in January's Baltimore magazine, we're just touching the surface. Ron, before we let you go, something was interesting, and Nestor, you probably have talked about this and looked at this over the years. It was counterintuitive to me, but you said that the opening of Harbor Place back in the 80s and then Harbor East later on actually strengthened Little Italy, and I think people would be surprised by that.
Yeah, that's by their own accounts. There's, we have like essentially had the biggest Little Italy in the country. New York is really. And I think one of the reasons is not, tremendous credit goes to all the families and all the restaurant owners who fought so hard and so creatively. But they've also benefited by like the Inner Harbor, right? Bringing a lot of tourism to Baltimore.
They were there before the harbor was nothing, right?
Right. And then it also, the Orioles moving from Waverly to Camden Yards also brought all those Philadelphia, New Yorkers, the Washingtonians, Bostonians. We know you guys know they come for the whole four-game series.
By the busloads.
They come for the whole four-game series. And that was a big business. And that's, 980 home games a year. And then Harbor East, well, yes, it became its own restaurant destination. Also, you have all these condos going up. And it's a bustling place. And essentially, you have new young people you can reach out to, maybe not going to come for the traditional like Italian food that I grew up on, but you can appeal to with carry out stuff, with lighter food, with some specialty items. I mean, Italians have, of course, Mediterranean great seafood you can appeal to another way. So that's been a blessing, actually. And I think one of the things that they talk about is trying to create a little more retail kind of business in Little Italy. Sid Wolf at Germano's talked about this. A little more of a, make it, you know, kind of link it to Harbor East and make it part of that walkable destination neighborhood. So maybe you go to Whole Foods or something, or CVS in Harbor East, and then you go across the street to Little Italy for your lunch outside or take dinner home. So, yeah.
Great stuff. Nestor, quick quiz for you before we let Ron get out of here. You're a pretty Baltimore guy. Do you know how Lombard Street got its name?
I do not, but it probably has something to do with corned beef.
No, it doesn't. Go ahead, Ron. I'm going to let you be the Alex Trebek here.
It was named by the Italians. It goes back to corned beef roe's name goes back to Lombardy region of Italy. Guidardi, I think, is actually what it would be like pronounced in Italian. So, but it goes to the history. Actually, it was a Jewish neighborhood before it was an Italian neighborhood. That the synagogue is nearby. So yeah, it goes to the whole changing.
I think that was chronicled in Avalon, if I'm not mistaken, as you know, as part of the moving from the city to Avalon to moving on. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, the migration to the northwest parts of the city and beyond. Yeah, exactly.
You are a Baltimore historian and not even a Baltimorean by birth, but we've adopted him in. Ron Cassie is at Baltimore Magazine covering everything from insurrections to inaugurations and all things around the city, books, the magazine, the Little Italy cover this month. Ron, we always appreciate you making time for us. Always a great visit.
Thank you guys so much. I appreciate everything you guys do.
Thank you. Keep up the great work.
Absolutely. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller, do not forget, we have an interview, sit down with Brandon Scott, our new mayor here, about all things, including restaurants and openings and bars. Make sure you're masking up out there and staying safe and following all the protocols as well. Also, Senate President Bill Ferguson joined us this month to talk about all things vaccine and how we're going to be distributing this. Lots of important stories, as well as that sit down with all the Baltimore County executives and our impeachapalooza and an incredible chat with Doug Mills, New York Times photographer, on all things historical and presidents and even a little bit of horseshoes. I am Nestor. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. Stay local. Support our sponsors out there. And whatever you do, order that sloppy Ness over to Meachie's.